Hi. Thank you for joining us at U Inc. My name is Rhea Greif, and I'm here with you today, as I am every week, to help build the most important brand in your life, which is you. When we talk about building, we use tools, and the same goes for building our brand. These wellness tools will help elevate your emotional intelligence and help to lead you in a more positive, successful direction in life and in business. Some of these tools you will find helpful today, and some you will press into your scrapbook for posterity. This week's tool is poeticism, and why it is important to have the ability to harness your life's poem as part of your success, and how to utilize this gift once I have demonstrated to you that this is a great tool for your brand. Writing poems in school, how it felt to be freed in this medium to express feelings and images and shaping them into words. In a safe, free setting, anyone of any age can gather words, play with language, and write poems. This playing with words is how discoveries of our internal world happen and spinning a web of intrigue about the world around us. Many of us have abandoned this art, but what if I told you that learning to express yourself in poetry actually helps poeticize, romanticize, and create passion and awareness in your life? So let's get right to the how we can do this. Although you can't really teach a person to write poetry, it has to come from the heart. The book, Poem Crazy, Freeing Your Life with Words by Susan Wooldridge, does try to give you a practical guide at getting to the very heart and intensity of life and the craft of expressing what one feels through the written word. Here is a sample exercise. Take a walk somewhere outside. Pretend you're the first person who has ever seen the plants and trees on this walk. It is your job to name them. Notice each type of tree. What does it look like? Is there something distinctive about the leaves or the shape of the trunk? Name each tree. Name the plants you see. Name the bugs. Name the spots you like to go on your walks, gardens, beaches, sections of town that are special to you. Name your car and your bicycle. Rename your street. Walk at night, especially when the moon is almost full. Go uphill. Rename the stars, the moon. Rename the sky. You get the idea. You then take these words and craft them into a poem. And you can do this with anything in your life by making and writing down these observations from your internal and external world as if looking at them for the first time and expressing them as such. And that is poeticism. The book, Poetry Will Save Your Life by Jill Bielaski, is an engaging examination of life that celebrates the enduring value of poetry, not as a purely cerebral activity, but as a means of conveying personal experience and as a source of comfort and intimacy. Poetry can be an integral part of life itself, and poems stand out like signposts at pivotal moments in a life. The death of a father, adolescence, first love, leaving home, the suicide of a sister, marriage, the birth of a child. Being able to look back upon these moments also helps to grasp how their importance and meaning evolved over time, allowing new insights and perceptions to emerge. And you can find all the scholarly books and peer-reviewed articles mentioned in our program on our webpage at wcbe.org. And if you miss a show, we podcast on SoundCloud, iTunes, or any old podcast app as U Inc. Radio. And be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as well for sweet updates. Have a suggestion for the show or a person that needs to be on U Inc. or a question for me? Get in touch at tworogues.com. We would love to hear from you. We can also take a dip in the more shallow end of the pool. Poeticizing our lives can be a useful tool to cope with life's trials and victories that aren't that deep. Let's face it, adulting is hard. Trying to find a good job in your field, navigating awkward social situations, saving up enough money, being in a relationship, finding a spot at the bar for happy hour are familiar adult struggles. No need to be eloquent unless you want to go there. You can keep it simple like, I thought living the grown-up life would be so freaking sweet. Instead, I work and trudge on home to pass out, rinse, and repeat. So grab a writing utensil and go for it. And congrats, you are now a poet of your life. Poetry arrived in search of me. I don't know where it came from. from winter or a river. I don't know how or when, and that is a quote from Pablo Neruda, which is his pen name, who became known as a poet by the age of 10, won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1971, and was called one of the greatest poets of the 20th century in any language. Somebody told me that the trouble at home, 'cause we never talk a lot when we spend time alone. Hey, so how are we supposed to know if something is wrong? Well, we've got a way to communicate. It keeps us happy. Hanif Abdurraqib is a poet, writer, and cultural critic from Columbus, Ohio. His essays and music criticisms have been published in The Fader, Pitchfork, The New Yorker, and The New York Times. With Big Lux, Hanif released a limited edition chapbook, Vintage Sadness, in the summer of 2017. He previously worked for MTV News, where he wrote about the intersections of music, culture, and identity. His full-length collection, The Crown Ain't Worth Much, was one of 2016's best-selling poetry books and was named a finalist for the Eric Hoffer Book Prize. Hanif's debut collection of essays titled They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us was published in November 2017 via $2 Radio and was named Book of the Year by BuzzFeed, Esquire, NPR, Oprah Magazine, Paste, The Los Angeles Review, Pitchfork, and The Chicago Tribune, among others. Mr. Abdurraqib spends his time traveling the country and sharing his words at various prestigious events and habitually represents Ohio with pride everywhere he goes. Welcome, Mr. Abdurraqib.
Thank you for having me.
So I have something that I found out about you is that we have something in common. We both love French fries.
And
so,
yeah, absolutely.
So here's my question. How do you eat your French fries?
Well, it depends on the fry, right? I think I don't really like super thin shoestring fries because they're only good when they're very hot. And then the minute they get cold, they're kind of useless. So I think a thick steak fry is really good because it retains like heat. And if it's kind of crisp, that could be great. And I usually do like light ketchup. I don't like ketchup a whole lot.
Okay.
Like a fry has to have something. It's a vehicle for a sauce.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
What about no mustard, no mayo? No
mayo sometimes.
Mayo,
yeah.
Right? And what about malt vinegar?
Depends on what I'm eating them with.
Okay.
So like fish and chip situation, of course, yeah.
Yes.
But just like straight up fries now.
Okay. So speaking about food, like on a more serious note, Hanif, in a lot of what I read in terms of an artist statement that you write about yourself, I often read the words such as French fries, milkshake, ice cream date, red velvet cake, dumplings. So is food the poetry of life for you, or food the poetry in life, or is food a form of poetry in life?
I think food's perhaps a form of poetry. A weird thing is I don't eat ice cream a lot anymore. I've cut down drastically, but I love it still.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think there's poetry in the mixing of flavors. I think there's poetry specifically in the making of a milkshake, right? About how if it's well made or gently made, it's like not too thick and tedious to consume, but also still really fulfilling.
And so you write about a lot of different things. So food is a large part of life. So you said you used to do milkshakes and now you cut down. So is this like the ebb and flow of kind of like the poetry of life food is?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Also, you know, I'm not that old, but I think I'm getting older. And so I have to like, you know, consider that I can't eat like I did when I was 21, which
right.
is I think everyone is thankful that I'm like trying to be a little healthier.
Oh, good.
But yeah, I mean, I still, you know, occasionally will go to like a United Dairy Farmers and get a milkshake.
I did see you mention that. That was it only exists between Columbus and Cincinnati.
Yeah, pretty much.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. It's like
a
gas station. You said it's a convenience store and it's an ice cream parlor, basically.
It's a pretty fascinating place.
Okay.
In Columbus, they're everywhere, especially on High Street. There's about one on every like three blocks. But
right.
Once you get kind of out of that Cincinnati area, you can't find them anywhere.
I did not know that. Okay, learned something. Okay, so in terms of taking life's interests and making poems out of them and in life, we mentioned bringing the tool poeticism to People's Brand, You Inc. And there are so many ways that one person can do that. And one way that you do that is that you write also about music. So Carly Rae Jepsen, Bruce Springsteen, Smashing Pumpkins, Fall Out Boy are some of the things that I had read that you had mentioned. So how does that evolution happen for you to start writing about music and working for MTV as opposed to writing songs themselves or just being a musician? So how did that happen? Kind of like the origin story of Hanif.
Right. I think that some people have an ear for creation and some people have an ear for criticism, which I think you can either translate ideas through music or you can translate ideas through language about the music.
Mm-hmm.
And I early on, it was very evident to me that I did not have the ability to to compose or translate thought or feeling through, you know, musical notes. I tried to play trumpet when I was younger and just did not, I didn't like the practice. I didn't like practicing it at all. I was not very good at it. I was good at being able to dissect sound and find language with which to discuss sounds and songs and lyrics that I was moved by. And so it just kind of seemed to me that the easiest thing to do was to translate the sound and not make the sound.
What were the outlets that you utilized younger to be able to present those criticisms and that critique, not really a criticism, but critique of the sound you heard?
Mostly just talking to my friends, right? Or like mostly just, yeah, I didn't write explicitly about music until much later, you know, it was maybe late teens when I first had the idea of writing about music. What I did do was annoy a lot of my friends by talking about the stuff I was listening to.
And,
you know, I think all music critics should be fans of the music first.
Right.
And I think by learning to be a fan, you learn how to dissect and discuss what you love. And that was an easy pathway into writing about music for me.
Okay, and so you are a fan of all these musical people that I had just mentioned, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And then so how does someone, you know, because you grew up in Ohio.
I grew up, yeah, Columbus.
And then how do you get to MTV? How does that then turn into, I'm just talking to my friends about it, fan of the music, this, that. How does that turn into MTV?
I think a lot of luck, you know. I think there's an interesting thing that people are interested. They hit a point where people were kind of interested in a voice that was writing about music that was perhaps a little more poetic and that was perhaps not as technically focused. And though I could be technically focused, I think my roots are in poetry. So, you know, I write about music as someone who loves it and is looking for what's underneath it and not just on top. And I think people took an interest in that and my work kind of began to circulate more and more. And then a friend of mine took a job editing at MTV and asked me if I wanted to join the staff there. And it was we had a great time.
Nice. Wow. And Eve, I'd mentioned that I was going to bring this up. You were once engaged not too long ago. Do you use poetry in general to overcome life's challenges? And even more so, we read all the time about how people try to like get out of being sad and don't experience the pain. And, you know, it's a very powerful tool for artists, pain is. How do you use, you know, pain and overcoming adversity and things that have happened in your life that were possibly made you sad? How do you use this in your life's poem as inspiration for others to do the same?
Well, I think it's important to note, too, that sadness and grief are both worthwhile things to feel and also not so singular things, right? I think that sadness is not only sadness and grief isn't only grief, but it's often, it exists as a reaction to or in concert with some joy that was once felt and some joy that will be ideally felt again. And so I think a lot about what I'm writing through to get to the other side of. And I mean, that's kind of helped me, but I also think that sometimes, you know, sadness is nuanced and sadness is a place where we can sit to find out some honest truths about ourselves. And so I think that sadness is generally more than just this looming dark cloud. And although I know that, you know, a lot of times it is simply that and nothing else. Mm-hmm. But there are times in which I have found a lot of great use out of the idea of sadness and ways that I could kind of make it my own and find it as a bridge to something greater as opposed to kind of just this like thing I'm standing in all the time.
So speaking of tough times, how do you handle, like poetically handle, harsh criticism of your work? For example, there was this lawyer from Winnipeg who's also a writer who described your 2016 poetry collection, and he was by far the minority. Like most of the things that I read had wonderful things to say about you. We'll talk about those too. But how do you poetically get over and handle harsh criticism? For example, this individual wrote about your poetry collection, The Crown Ain't Worth Much, as self-indulgent, ungrammatical, and enamored of the almighty eye.
I mean, I don't read that kind of stuff, but I also think that, yeah, you know, it's a book about my surviving things that I shouldn't have survived. So it's absolutely self-indulgent.
Right.
And, you know, not everyone has the privilege to exist in uncertainty and fear, you know, or like everyone, so there are some people who have the privilege to not know those things. And I think to know those things is to perhaps indulge in your surviving of them.
Okay. In the Columbia Daily Tribune, where you were heralded as one of America's great young poets, as evidenced in the 2016 book, again, The Crown Ain't Worth Much, as one of our best thinkers on matters of popular music, and he once again shows a deft ability to sweep the corners of pop culture to find the particular and the profound. The article ends by saying, misguided, often deeply ignorant people complain about the presence of Black History Month on our calendars and in our culture, but if we read Abdur-Aqib with integrity and good good faith, we'll see our need to be historians each and every day. So one of the things we had talked about before you had come on the show today is I asked you if you would be so kind as to read something on U Inc. than you had accepted. Can you tell us what you're going to be reading today and why you chose this piece?
I'm going to read a section of a thing from my essay book, They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us. And it's about Michael Jordan and Allen Iverson. And I'm going to just read a small section of it. There was a point in the 90s, in 1996, when Michael Jordan was defending Allen Iverson, and Allen Iverson dribbled past him, and it was an older Michael Jordan and a younger Allen Iverson, and it meant a lot for a lot of young basketball players that I knew coming up, so I thought that it made sense to read that. I came up with people who played basketball on the east side of Columbus here, so it made sense to read.
Okay.
So I'm going to read a part of an essay called It Rained in Ohio on the Night Allen Iverson Hit Michael Jordan with a Crossover. Michael Jordan never threw a chair during a brawl, as far as we know. He had his share of indecencies, many of them rooted in gambling and infidelity, things that came fully to light after he was out of the game for good. But Jordan, in some ways, was the anti-Iverson. No one would ever call Michael Jordan a thug, a label Iverson was saddled with from the first stages of his career and probably for much of his life before he entered the NBA. Michael Jordan spoke clearly to reporters and flashed a wide smile with perfect teeth. Michael Jordan endorsed good things like healthy cereal and sports drinks. People died over Michael Jordan's shoes once, but let's not talk about that part. Michael Jordan was the kind of black person people wouldn't mind living next to. Michael Jordan was just as competitive as Allen Iverson, but he wore it better. Michael Jordan probably didn't love his teammates as much, though. He punched one of them in the face during a practice, but at least he showed up to practice. You can't terrorize your teammates at practice if you don't show up to practice. There were two NBAs, it seemed. The one of black players who fit into the Jordan personality archetype, and, by the time Allen Iverson came along, black players who decidedly did not.
So is this kind of like a commentary with the new guard versus the old guard?
Yeah. I mean, I think though it mentions race, I think it's more about the passage of time and age and kind of, for me as a basketball player who was not that great but enjoyed watching the game and enjoyed playing it, to grow up in the era of Allen Iverson was really exciting.
There's a particular Jordan shoe that you like, right? Now that you mentioned it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have a lot of sneakers on the sneaker parts, but I like the Jordan 3. It's probably my favorite sneaker of all.
Okay. Yeah. And, you know, since you're reading from your book, I noticed that the cover of your other book also had a wolf on it. Does
yes.
the wolf mean something to you?
Yeah. So there's a poem that opens The Crown Ain't Worth Much called On Hunger that details this dream I was having about wolves and how by nature they're hunters in dreams about worlds where they were the only ones left surviving after the world collapsed. Which is probably not true, right? They're endangered in so many spaces.
Yes, that's true.
But right. The fact that, you know, one of the great hunters of the animal kingdom can become endangered is a very, like, jarring thing for me. You know, I kind of want wolves to live forever, so I wanted to create a lineage of book covers in which wolves were alive always.
I love it. So your essays have ways of combining ideas. So no piece is really about one single thing. We talked about like that kind of dissonance, that concert at the same time being beautiful and fearful. And then we talk about, I had read about, you had talked a lot about vulnerability, and it's important to be able to feel that. And people have fear about vulnerability. Do you feel that vulnerability and the fear of vulnerability is intersectional?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that depending on how you identify or how you were raised or you know, you're not always given a blueprint for vulnerability. And so the idea of feelings in general can be a bit frightening. I have often spent a lot of my adult life learning a language for how to feel and how to express my feelings while also making space for other people to feel things and express their feeling of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that exchange is really important and helps kind of dull the fear that people have. The simple saying of you're not alone to someone is really vital.
Right. And you talked about like not everyone has been privileged enough to have grown up without feeling that they've gone through some really tough times like you have. You had mentioned like the Paris attacks and things like that. Tell us about some of those challenges and some of those vulnerabilities that you experienced growing up that kind of lended towards the poem of your life.
Yeah. I mean, my mother passed when I was young. I think that impacted me in a lot of ways. But, you know, beyond that, I, you know, was Muslim in America before and then after 9/11, and that it was a very jarring shift, I think, in the mm-hmm. way that I learned that the world saw me and the way I sat in the world. And those things were not easy to navigate. Those mm-hmm. are two big things that come to mind.
Right, sure.
But I think that, you know, writing offered me a way into creating language for both of those things and then finding a way out of them.
Your schedule seems really grueling, yet you have prolific output. I mean, every time I did research, it's like you did another thing, another interview, another person you were talking to. So content across the board, prolific, social media even, books, poetry, writing bios for other people's albums and so on. How does one remain poetic about life and just being able to produce when they have so many things demanding their attention? How do you do it?
Well, I committed myself to getting at least seven hours to sleep every night last year, which I mean, some nights it's tricky because I have such early flights, but then I try to make up for it. You know, I try to like not be tired. Mm-hmm. Right? I try to run on a lot of sleep if I can. Mm-hmm. And if I'm home, which has been tricky lately, I've been bouncing around, but I try to go to the gym. Mm-hmm. Because it's a place where I can kind of leave my phone in the car, leave my phone in a locker and just kind of zone out. In my days that are busy, I try to build small and kind of brief sanctuaries inside of them where I am only answering for myself and no one else. And I think that is a really propelling force so that when I return to the work, I'm excited to go back to it.
Right. And that's what helps you kind of keep the creativity going.
Yeah.
I like that. And only answering to myself. That's good. Okay, so speaking of so many demands on your attention, I also always look at people's social media too. So on a social media post you had written, please believe me when I say that a good 28% of my life is spent booking travel while staring at Expedia and whispering, man, this is some to no one but the computer screen. And that's the part they don't talk about in fancy Q&As. So let's talk about that. What kind of music are you playing during that time, maybe during that right booking now game? And have you written anything to poeticize this one third of your life?
No. I mean, one third is maybe generous. I should have like turned down a bit.
Okay.
But I often am listening to like the poppiest pop music during that time because it's something that I know and can sing along to. I think like booking travel is something, I would like say that I have a really great agent who books a lot of my travel, right? But I also travel for like recreational purposes.
Sure.
I also, you know, have to like do a flight out of somewhere and into somewhere else. That is like a pre-existing trip. I have to add another flight on.
Right.
So that's just like an exhausting thing, you know, to like, and I try to do it all at once. So it's not only exhausting, but it's like the financial weight of it makes, you know, you're like, I'm spending so much money in this one sitting. But I like listening to like Whitney Houston or something. I know all the words too.
Okay. All right. I love that mug that you have a picture of. If the love it like R&B music from the 90s,
yeah.
I don't want it.
Yeah.
Is it really is something very special about that time and the way the music sounded? It's just so soulful. It's like, I'll die without you. And it really meant it.
Yeah.
You know, I just love that. Okay, so speaking of music, in a piece you wrote for Muzzle, the online literary magazine titled The Summer A Tribe Called Quest Broke Up, you write in the author about the author part, you write, this is something else that you had written, and I quote, he wants you to tell him your top five albums of all time. So basically you're reaching out saying that's what Hanif Abdur-Rakib would want for you to tell them what your top five albums are. So of course this begs the question, what are your top five albums?
Oh, I don't know. Mine change a lot.
Okay.
I hope that everyone's changed a lot.
Right.
You know? I hope that everyone has kind of a fluid relationship with the things they love. So my, you know, today, I don't even know, Fleetwood Mac's Tusk probably, Julian Baker's Turn Out the Lights, Sampha's Process. I've been listening to like the last Kalayla album a lot, and anything by Fela Kuti right now.
Okay. All right. I'm going to look those up and I'll put all of those in our library too, so people can access those if they want to. And then I'll choose some of those songs to be like kind of our bumper music, which is great. So Hanif, the more I read about you, the more I really swoon. Honestly, you're having a moment right now. You have been having it for a while. But tell us some of the things that you are kind of working on, some upcoming projects that are going to be published, maybe some places we can see you, not just in Columbus, and where people can get your books.
Yeah. So the hope is that, you know, I think like it's important to think about ways to like stretch whatever quote unquote moment is into like a whole life or like a whole life of work.
Yeah.
And so I'm working on a lot. I'm working on a new book of poems that I hope to have out in 2019. I'm working on a biography of A Tribe Called Quest, which is coming out in early 2019 with University of Texas Press.
Wow.
And I have two books with Random House coming out in 2020 and 2022. So those are all kind of like things I'm working on now. And it's a lot. I'm all over
that's
the place.
That's incredible.
My website is abdurrakib.com.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where all of my all my work is and all my dates are listed.
And we can purchase your books from your website as well?
You can as well. Yep.
Okay. So you're a big fan of Ohio.
I am.
And everywhere you go, like I saw that you had written somewhere in Chicago just the other day, like Ohio
against
the world last night. What kind of things do you have in terms of Ohio, like tattoos or things at home and things like that that also represent?
I don't have tattoos. I don't have any tattoos. I always want to get tattoos, but I think that I'm too nervous because I get too anxious about
it. Then I get bored of it. That's the way I don't do it. Yeah.
But I love tattoos. I have this cool bracelet that's someone made that's falling apart now.
Oh, nice.
But it's a wooden bracelet that has the shape of Ohio on it and Ohio engraved in the Ohio pennant. And that means a lot to me. I need to get a new one.
Oh, that's nice.
But I like it a lot.
Okay. I know that we are very, very grateful that you continue to represent Ohio. And thank you for coming here on Ewing Today, Hanif Abdurraqib.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Now, a word from our person on the street. So, Manya, what are your thoughts on poetry?
Poetry, I would say, reminds me of my childhood in dance. It was something that I could relate to that was strong and firm, like dancing in hard shoes as an Irish dancer or in point shoes, pounding my feet into the floor, making sure I was high off my heels, or something as soft and light as watching the Swan Lake, or dancing a slip jig, or a reel to music. It was something very poetic when listening to an Irish fiddle or a soft lullaby. It was something that I could find relaxing if I needed, or it was something that I could find empowerment in, whether or not it was after a long day of hard school or after work activities. It's something that spoke to me that just made me feel better. It was like a rush of waves that cleared my head. I didn't have to worry about how bad my feet were hurting, how bad my calves were, or the schoolwork that I still had to finish after a 2.5-hour class. It was something that flushed over me and made me feel strong, and it was very relaxing, and it meant that I didn't have to worry at the end of it.
Uh-huh. Do you actually write poetry?
As a little girl, I dabbled, tried to see what I could rhyme together, see if anything would rhyme with orange, found out quickly that nothing did, saw what I could with fruits for a while, mm-hmm. see what I could tap in with those. I really like to write about windows, as I thought there were so many ways to incorporate light and dark and openings and closings, which I found were very intriguing to myself at a young age. I also thought structures of buildings were really interesting, whether or not it was a chapel of some sort or a temple with its stained glass windows that just blossomed with beautiful light from their colors, and or if it was just a plain red brick house that really spoke to me. It was very calming. I could sit out and have a wonderful tea and hang out with some friends and have a casual day.
Well, I'm sure you found a lot of friends to hang out, because just listening to you is like listening to a poem. I'm so relaxed. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you.
And that's our show for today, folks. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm Maria Greif, and you've been listening to U Inc. on 90.5 WCBE.